Well, good morning to you all. For those who are visitors, I've been meandering my way preaching through talks about the stories of the patriarchs, and so we're sort of in the middle of that, and this is sort of a part two in a way. We talked last time about Jacob meeting Esau, and now we're going to talk about Jacob leaving Esau. So I don't know if we can use my left side up here and use it for a children's class. I apologize for booting you young ladies out. So if the children want to come forward, and we're going to have... Okay, so... Do you all know what this is? This little notebook. So, yeah. Okay. So I'm going to give you this, Grayson. And Victoria. Do you all have pencils with you? Yeah. Well, you're not going to write on this. So this is, okay. And I'll make one for myself, too, because I want to have part of this. Everybody else is just going to have to watch us. So... So what is this? Yes, Grayson. It's a piece of notebook paper. We just say it's a piece of paper. It's not a very big piece of paper, is it? No, it isn't. So we're going to crumple it up. So I want you, each one of you, to take it and just squish it up. So we'll see who can make the smallest ball. Okay? So tell me when you're done. You're done. Okay, so whose ball is the smallest? This is how big mine is. Let's see if any of you got yours smaller than mine. Okay, well, Grayson's about the same size, so probably if we got the strong young men up here, they can make a little tiny thing. And if you chewed on it, you can make it even smaller yet, but we're not going to do that. Okay, so I would like to think about sometimes you do things that are kind of not kind to other people, and they're kind of mean to other people. And so when you do that, it's a little bit like taking this ball, this piece of paper, and wrapping it up into a ball. It doesn't look the same, does it? Not at all. So what do you do when you do something kind of mean to somebody else? Like, let's say it's a brother or a sister. Yes, Grayson.
Well, I'd probably call them ugly names if I was being mean.
Okay, so you'd call them ugly names. But afterwards, you feel kind of bad about that. And so... So let's say it was Sophie that you called an ugly name. So what would you do? Elise, what would you do if you called Victoria an ugly name? You wouldn't do that. Okay. Okay. So what do you think, Victoria, you should do if you do something kind of mean to somebody else?
Tell the truth.
Tell the truth, okay. What? You should say sorry and ask for forgiveness. That's right. So let's take our papers and let's open them back up and see what we can do here. Okay. So this is kind of like what happens when we ask forgiveness, okay? So do you think my paper looks the same now as it did beforehand? It doesn't, does it? It's still kind of crumply. And it's even got a little hole in it. Oh, dear. This is terrible. Saying sorry didn't really fix it, did it? So, you know, you could probably still write on it, you could draw on it, but it's just not the same afterwards. And so sometimes we think, you know, I'll just say sorry and everything is better. But sorry doesn't make everything better, does it? Sometimes people feel bad after you do something. But I was thinking about this, and, you know, Jesus went to the town of Nazareth, and he got up, and he asked for the prophet, the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. So they didn't have Bibles like we had. They had scrolls, didn't they? And he read this passage from the prophet Isaiah. He said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." So this is talking about myself, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor and sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And so a lot of times we do something and we can't really make it better, but Jesus can. So Jesus is the one who can heal the brokenhearted. That's wonderful, isn't it? So sometimes if somebody does something mean to you and they don't even ask for forgiveness, Jesus can still heal that, can't he? So you all can go back to your parents. So I thought, as a way of starting, I would talk about the history of anesthesia. So some of you have been under anesthesia, and some of you haven't. But if you had to have something major done, you would be glad for anesthesia. Anesthesia is something that very few people probably brought up at Thanksgiving as something they were thankful for. But it's a wonderful thing. So there's no one person who can say that they invented anesthesia, at least not the way that we use it today. In the East, a lot of times people used opium to make them insensible to pain so that they could do operations without too much trouble. Western cultures, people use alcohol. They drink a lot of alcohol, and then they would hope that they didn't feel the pain quite so much. A man named Henry Hickman decided to give animals enough carbon dioxide to smother them, and he found he could easily operate on them. But of course, this is not a very good thing, because if you smother somebody enough that you can operate on them, they may not come back afterwards. So the surgery is successful, but the patient didn't make it. But in the 1840s, people began to have nitrous oxide parties. Who knows what nitrous oxide is? Bethany. Okay, Elliot, laughing gas, that's right. So they had nitrous oxide parties. This is kind of a weird party, isn't it? Maybe this could be something our youth could have. Be fun, wouldn't it? Anyway, so people would breathe in this nitrous oxide, and then some of them would act really silly. And at one of these parties, there was a dentist actually, named Dr. Horace Wells. And he saw a man who gashed his leg after taking in some nitrous oxide, and he didn't even seem to feel pain. And so Dr. Wells thought about this, and, you know, he's a dentist, and his patients never enjoyed having their teeth pulled. Well, he thought, you know, this would be wonderful. I can pull people's teeth, and it won't bother them. And so that's what he started doing. He started using nitrous oxide for pain control, and it worked pretty well. And so he got a whole bunch of people together. This was in Boston, and he gave somebody nitrous oxide, and he pulled a tooth. And right as he pulled the tooth, the man screamed out in pain. Ah! And so all these newspapers that had been covering this story jumped on this, and they said, that Dr. Wells is a humbug. I don't know what a humbug is, but anyway, they didn't seem to think he had much truth about him. Well, Dr. Wells had a partner, Dr. William Morton, and he took this idea and he thought, well, is there anything better? And so he started using ether as an anesthetic, and he found that worked really well. And so in 1846, he convinced a surgeon, Dr. John Collins Warren, to let him administer ether while he took a tumor off a man's neck. And it was successful. The man didn't flinch or cry out. And at the end of this operation, Dr. Warren turned to the men who were watching. It's kind of strange to have an operation. I have a whole bunch of people there covering it as a story. And he said, gentlemen, this is no humbug. And so the newspapers went out and wrote this story. Well, this changed everybody. But the interesting thing is that soon thereafter, Dr. Charles T. Jackson, another doctor, came forward and claimed that Dr. Morton had stolen his idea for ether as an anesthetic. He had told Dr. Morton to try it, and Dr. Morton had, and now was getting all the credit that was deserved by Dr. Jackson. And from this came a huge conflict between these doctors as to who should get credit for this discovery. Dr. Morton even went to his senator and said, I want Congress to pass a bill saying that I, Dr. Morton, am responsible for the introduction of anesthesia. He wanted it for the world, for the world. They went back and forth, and finally in 1868, Dr. Morton died, and his wife put on his tombstone, before whom in all time surgery was agony, by whom pain in surgery was averted, since whom science has control over pain. It's a lot to put on a tombstone. It must have been pretty good sized, right? So anyway, one day in 1873, so about 5 years later, Dr. Jackson was walking through this cemetery and he found this tombstone. And it so upset him that he had a stroke and he never talked again. He ended up spending the rest of his days in an asylum. And interestingly, he's buried in the same cemetery as Dr. Morton. And this inscription is on his tombstone. So it says, through his observations of the peculiar effects of sulfuric ether on the nerves of sensation and his bold deduction therefrom, the benign discovery of painless surgery was made. That's a lot to put on tombstone too. Most of us just have a name and maybe like a birth and death date. But anyway, these men's relatives decided to put this discovery on their tombstones, even if nobody else knew about it. You all probably didn't even know about these people, did you? So as we think about these two men, we see that their lives were ruined by their conflict over the desire to receive credit for this discovery. And an interesting thing is that in Jackson, Georgia, there was another doctor. So lots of doctors this morning. Dr. Crawford Long. He was both a surgeon and a pharmacist. And he had started using ether as an anesthetic in 1842, so 4 years before Dr. Warren had done this famous operation. And when he discovered this controversy, he did collect some patient testimonials and wrote to a scientific society saying that he had started using ether before either of these two fellows. And it didn't seem to bother him too much when the scientific society didn't say much about it. And later on, in 1878, he just helped deliver a baby when he had a stroke and died, but he said about his profession that it was a ministry from God and that his highest ambition was to do good and leave the world better by his labors. So this whole story strikes me badly. The question is one of forgiveness and unforgiveness. Could we say that pride kept these men from settling their dispute? So I think Galen mentioned it the last time I preached, but Lewis B. Smead said that to forgive is to set a prisoner free and discover that that prisoner is you. Matthew 18, verses 21 and 22. Then Peter came to him and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I forgive him? Up to seven times? Jesus said to him, I do not say to you up to seven times, but up to 70 times seven. And this passage is a challenging one. I think part of the problem is that we equate forgiveness and reconciliation. So just because you've forgiven somebody doesn't mean that you reconcile with them, and it certainly doesn't mean you trust them. So if you have a brother who has stolen seven times from you, you do not have to let him hold your wallet or watch your cash register. Forgiveness is more about releasing feelings of anger, a desire for vengeance, and bitterness against someone who has offended or harmed you in some way. And I know we've talked about this already, but I really wanted to explore this a little bit more. So we're going to go to Genesis chapter 33, and we're going to read the second half of this chapter, verses 12 through 20. So the first part of the chapter talks about Jacob coming on Esau. He abases himself. He puts himself down on the ground. Esau raises him up, hugs him, says, I am so glad to see you. And now we're coming to the part where after Jacob's given him a gift, they decide that they're going to part. Except Esau doesn't really think that they should part. So beginning Genesis 33, verse 12. Then Esau said, "Let us take our journey. Let us go, and I will go before you." But Jacob said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard just one day," I added the just, "but hard one day, all the flock will die. Please let my Lord go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Seir." And Esau said, "Now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth, built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came to Paddan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought a parcel of land where he pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel. So let's begin by saying some things that happened in this chapter. So first of all, Esau hugged and raised up Jacob. Jacob attempted to make restitution by giving Esau a whole bunch of stuff. And Esau extended a welcome for Jacob to accompany him to the place where Esau and presumably Esau and Jacob's father, Isaac, were living. So Isaac lived by Esau and was probably cared for by Esau's wives. Isaac was blind 20 years before. He's certainly not able to care for himself anymore. So what didn't happen in this story? So Jacob never brought up his hurtful behavior from the past. He never asked how Esau had dealt emotionally with this or what sort of thing he could do to make things right. He did make restitution, but it was based on his own perception as to what was right and not what Esau might have thought was right. He never apologized for the ways in which he behaved in the past, and he didn't commit to honoring the relationship going forward, to valuing Esau as an individual. So what's the end result? Well, we find at the end of this story that Esau is very comfortable with Jacob and wants Jacob to move in next door to him. On the other hand, Jacob is still very uncomfortable being around Esau. Esau says, "Come with me." And Jacob says, "But we'll move too slow." And he's exaggerating, isn't he? He says, "If we go one day too fast, every one of my animals will die." It's probably exaggeration, don't you think? They probably wouldn't all die. I mean, at most, 5 or 10%. But all of them, it seems unlikely. Well, Esau says, "That's okay. I'll leave some men with you to protect you on your way." And Jacob says, no, there's no need for that. You just go on and I'll take my merry old time and I'll come to Mount Seir in my own time." And Esau says, "Okay, well, I'll expect you." And Jacob goes the opposite direction. He's telling Esau lies. Can we come up with reasons why Jacob wouldn't want to live near Esau? Well, sure we can. We could say that Esau's wives would corrupt Jacob's family. They didn't love God. And maybe his family would be in worse shape if they lived next door to each other. We could say that Esau was a man who in the past wasn't trustworthy, and so maybe it's not a good idea for Jacob to trust him now. But the point is that because Jacob had not been honest with Esau, he could not tell him any of this stuff. And he couldn't say, "You know what, Esau? I don't feel comfortable living next door to you, but I would like to have some communication with you and build our trust back over some time." Instead, he just moved the other direction. And as far as we can tell, he didn't have any communication with him at all. So Jacob moved to Succoth and bought some land and set up little houses to be the base of operations for his adventures in Canaan. And the story finishes with Jacob erecting an altar and calling it El Elohim Israel. And the name means the Mighty One is the God of Israel. And I think the important thing here is to see that Jacob knew who was responsible for taking him safely back to the land. Jacob knew that he had been in some pretty dangerous situations along the way. And it was because of God that he had made it through. Another thing that we need to remember is that Israel is not the name of a nation at this point. Israel is the name of a man. And it's a man who's just gotten a new name. So Jacob, till this point, has been known as Jacob, heel grabber, deceiver, and now he's known as Israel, one who wrestles with God. And when we come through a time of stress, through a time of struggle, the important thing is that we realize who brought us through that and that we honor God and sacrifice to him. So we're going to move from here to thinking a little bit more about forgiveness. So when I was a little younger, I was in a church that went through a very difficult church split. And I hadn't been in that church very long, and so I didn't have the connections with the people who left. But the pastor in that church was deeply hurt by the people who left, and he struggled with it. And we knew that he struggled because he preached for 8 or 9 sermons in a row. And he was preaching every Sunday because most of the ministry had left. He preached for 8 or 9 Sundays in a row on forgiveness. And as he preached, I think all of us could feel that he personally was reaching to find this forgiveness in his own life. People had said hard things about him, and he'd had family who left, and he just felt let down by everything, and he was struggling. And I think there are a lot of people who would show up in this sort of situation and would just say, just forgive. Just let it go. And that's all well and good, but I think it's helpful for us to break down what it means. What do we need to do to go through to successfully forgive? And maybe a question that we should think about is, do we need to forgive because God forgave us so much? Or do we forgive because we desire to receive God's forgiveness? That's a hard question to answer, isn't it? In one sense, God forgives us before we've ever forgiven. And that is true. And yet, if we want to continue to receive God's forgiveness going forward, we need to forgive. If you remember the story of the ungrateful servant who was unforgiving to his fellow servant, he was forgiven by his Lord. But when he went out and was not willing to forgive his fellow servant, he was cast into prison. And as I read that story, I think he was cast into prison until such time as he said, you know what, I relinquish my need for payment on this debt that you owe me, this much smaller debt. So how do we reach forgiveness in our own lives? Because it isn't easy. So first of all, we need to begin by being honest about what offense was done to us. Forgiveness is not telling somebody else that this was nothing, that I wasn't hurt. Forgiveness is letting somebody else know that the pain is and was real, but grace is stronger. And that's important. The second thing is to move from this point to attempting to see the person as somebody who has value. Tell yourself a story about why the person is the way that they are. You are not excusing their injustice to you or their offense. You have felt that injustice, and it has hurt you. But that person does have value to God. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, then God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Look around you this morning. All those people sitting beside you are created in the image of God. The Imago Dei. If I had a mirror and I could let each one of you hold the mirror and you looked in that mirror, you would see the image of God. Does that strike you as a powerful thing this morning? A scary thing? All of us have value because God created us with value. And if we can see somebody else as having that image of God, it will help us to extend forgiveness. Forgiveness is altruism. It is a gift on our part, and we do not need to look at it as anything less than that. As we talked about it last time, we read the story of the unforgiving servant. He had been forgiven a huge amount, and then he went and was unwilling to extend forgiveness to his fellow servant. He didn't see these two situations as related, but his master chose to make them related. So how can we understand this grace and extend it to other people? Well, first of all, if we can see some benefit from the suffering that we've been through, it will help us. So it is important that we are not saying that suffering is good. Suffering is not good. It doesn't feel good to us. It causes us pain. But if we can somehow understand that we have learned something because of what we've been through, it's helpful. So we know that God is able to bring beauty from ashes. That's in Isaiah 61:3. He makes bad things work together for good. Romans 8:28. And if you can ask yourself, after you've been through something really hard, what has God done in my life as a result of this suffering? And you can see something good, some way in which you've drawn closer to God, closer to somebody else. That's helpful. Second thing is that we need to realize how great a gift we've been given. So we can't pay for our forgiveness. I've shared this example before, but if my youngest daughter, who's 5, would go out to my truck and take a stone and just scratch up the paint all over the truck, scratch it up, terrible shape, and she would come inside and she would say, "Dad, I'm sorry, I scratched up the paint on your truck, but I will pay for it." I would say, "You don't need to," because she has $2 and she can't pay for it. But I'm her father and I love her and I will forgive her. And I will tell her, "Don't do it again. But I still love you and I will forgive you, because even though you can't pay for the damage that was done, I am going to give you grace." And that's what we are. All of us wants to pay God back for what's been done, and yet we can't. We don't have the resources. We need to work on it. So the deeper the offense, the greater the injustice gap, the more effort is going to be required to forgive. And I keep saying this, but I'm going to say it again. Forgiveness does not remove punishment or mean reconciliation. So there's just times when something needs to be taken care of legally, and there's plenty of times where somebody just doesn't feel safe in somebody else's presence, and that's okay too. Start small. So if you've got something major in your life that you are dealing with unforgiveness, that may not be the thing to start with. Maybe start by forgiving something very small that your spouse or your brother or your sister or somebody else said to you. Practice makes perfect. So people who make a practice of forgiving other people will find that they're more able to forgive, more ready to forgive when they're confronting a small or a big slight. And realize that forgiveness helps the person who's extending forgiveness, not just the person who's receiving it. So sometimes we think of forgiveness as being a way of letting other people off the hook. But as we forgive other people, we benefit. So maybe kind of as a way of wrapping this up, it's very important for us to note that forgiveness is not a magic bullet. So some people almost use forgiveness like an instrument of a weapon to tell people that the reason why they are struggling now is because they just haven't forgiven things from their past. And I don't think that's true at all. Just because you've forgiven doesn't mean that your emotions are suddenly healed or that your life is perfect. At the same time, I do think we as Christians have a responsibility to extend that to other people. And then commit to this. So some people would say actually write down in your journal someplace, I forgive John Waldron today, and write the date for, and then write that down. And in the future, you can remember this date. We're going to go to Matthew 18. We're going to read verses 15 through 19. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more, that by the mouth of two or three witnesses every word may be established. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. But if he refuses even to hear the church, let him be to you like a heathen and a tax collector. Assuredly, I say to you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Again, I say to you that if two of you agree on earth concerning anything they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there in the midst of them. For some reason or another, when we read this passage, we see it as talking about church discipline. And I know it's probably because that word sin is in there. But I think that the focus of this passage is on relationships. Jesus is saying that our relationships with our brothers and sisters in the Lord are very important. And if possible, we should address forgiveness issues with people who offend us directly. And if we're not comfortable doing it alone, we should take somebody along with that conversation. And this is a big enough deal that the answer for people who are unwilling to extend forgiveness, it can be excommunication. Jesus says he should be to you as a tax collector or a heathen. The point is that we no longer do sacramental life with a person who is living in a state of disharmony with a fellow believer. And for whatever reason, this doesn't feel like a big deal to us. Probably because we can't judge hearts, but it is a big deal to God. He wants to see us in harmony with the people around us, that we do church with, that we live beside each other. We call each other brothers and sisters, and we are sometimes like this. So I think the question now moves to what should we do if we are the offender? So a lot of discussion about forgiveness focuses on people forgiving other people. And the question is, if you realize that you have done something that harms somebody else, what should you do in response? Simon Wiesenthal was a Jew. And he wrote a book called The Sunflower, which told the story about how he was in a concentration camp in Poland. And one day he went out to a hospital, and he and some other Jews were responsible for carrying medical waste out of the hospital. And while he was working there, a nurse came and motioned for him to follow her. And she led him through the hospital, up some stairs, up more stairs, and finally to a little tiny room up near the top floor of the hospital. And then she left him in that room. And there in bed in that room was a Nazi soldier who was dying of injuries that he'd sustained. He'd been burned over most of his body. He was bandaged. And he wanted to see Simon because he wanted to see a Jew. And there at the bedside, Simon listened to this Nazi soldier who told him about a war crime that he'd done where he and other Nazis had rounded up Jewish people and put them inside a house in a town in Ukraine, and then they had set the house on fire and they shot the people as they came out. And then at the end of this, he asked Simon to extend forgiveness to him. He said, "I have suffered much. I have been in the hospital for months. I'm not getting better. I want you, on behalf of all the Jews, to forgive me for what I've done." And Simon listened to him, and then he left the room silently without giving forgiveness. Next day, he went back to the hospital, and the nurse told him that the soldier had died. And the soldier had left him his belongings, and Simon was shocked, and he didn't want them, and he said, "Send them to his mother. I don't want these things." So in the book, Simon asked the question, what was the right thing to do for this dying man? And lots of people wrote little essays talking about that in the book. But as I thought about it, a few things stood out to me. First of all, the soldier's confession was not a very good confession. He excused himself for his part in the suffering of the Jews. He was a Nazi, but he had become a Nazi because he was young and impressionable, and that's what everybody around him was doing. More than that, he believed that because he'd suffered so much pain from his burns that he should be forgiven. And maybe a final thing to mention is that Simon could not forgive on behalf of the people who died. He wasn't even a member of their family. So all of this leads to the question of what our responsibility is if we realize that we have harmed somebody else, even if it was unintentional, even if we can come up with reasons why we did what we did. So the Jewish word, the Hebrew word for repentance is teshuvah, and it includes some really important concepts that we need to take into place. So first of all is that we need to go to the person who's offended. One of the important things is that we do not just confess to God, but we confess to a real individual. And if we cannot confess to the person, we should confess to their family or to someone who can be a stand-in for them. And this is maybe kind of the opposite point from Matthew 18. So Matthew 18 talks about the person who is forgiving going to the offender, but the offender can still go to the person who they offended. Second thing is to confess the hurt without excuse. So you may have had a reason for what you did, but this is not the place to mention it. It only weakens the confession. Offer an apology for what you did. You are truly sorry. You need to note the other person's pain and acknowledge it and that you were the source of this pain. Minimizing the pain or indicating that they are blowing things out of proportion is not helpful and only weakens your attempt to restore the relationship. You need to state that the person is valuable to you and they will continue to be valuable in the future. So you understand that what you did indicated the person wasn't valuable to you and you are sorry for that. You want to make restitution for the offense. You know that you cannot make things as they were before. So just like those pieces of paper that the children crumpled up, things will not be perfect. At least we can't make them perfect. But we are still willing to do what the other person puts as the value of the offense. And then you need to say that you will try your very best to make sure this doesn't happen again. So we need to be honest. So if you're somebody who forgets birthdays and anniversaries, and this really upsets somebody that you live with, you need to say, you know, "I am going to do my best. I'm going to set reminders on my phone for next year." But if you're somebody who forgets these things frequently, then saying never again is just a recipe for disaster. And I think a final thing is that for teshuva to really happen, you need to behave differently when faced with the same situation in the future. So it is not about just confession. It is about a changed path. So if that soldier had been in this town in Ukraine and a different set of Jews were rounded up, he needs to be willing to say, this is not right. I will not take part in this. I will do whatever I can to stop this. So we've been wandering around this, but Jacob and Esau never really fully healed their relationship. And our goal in church is not to have a bunch of distant, sort of uneasy relationships with people. It's to have true harmony and shalom. Forgiving ourselves. So this is something, I think Delvin had mentioned this last time. And I wasn't sure if I should bring this up, and if so, how much to say about it. So folks who are on the narcissistic end of the spectrum don't ruminate over their sins of the past, and for them, the focus should be on repentance and restitution. But at a certain point, when you've done what you could, and you have received forgiveness, you need to be able to forgive yourself and move forward. So, of course, if you met a serial killer on death row and he told you he's been working with a therapist and he's killed 16 different people, but he's decided to forgive himself for all 16 of those murders and he just feels really good about that decision, you would say, that's crazy. What have you done to repent, to move forward, and to restore a relationship? Well, nothing really. I told you the story the last time about Everett Worthington and about how his 90-year-old mother was killed by a burglar. It was a terrible thing, and he struggled to forgive the person who had killed his mother. 9 years after that, he was in Knoxville, Tennessee, and he went out to eat with his brother, and his brother told him that he still had flashbacks to the scene when he entered the house and found his mother. His brother Mike would often sit in a darkened room, feeling deep despair, feeling trapped and unable to move. And Everett told his younger brother, you know, Mike, you need to see a therapist. Maybe you need some medicine. I think it would help you. You've got the symptoms of PTSD. And his brother told him in no uncertain terms, I'm not going to see a shrink. And Everett was upset because he was a shrink. He was a psychologist. And he took offense, really. He said, well, whatever. And he dropped it. He's like, whatever. If you want to be that way, just be that way. About 6 months later, he got a call from his brother's wife telling him that his brother had committed suicide. And immediately, he felt a sense of guilt. He hadn't done what he could for his brother. He had known that Mike was struggling, and he just didn't push hard enough for him to get the help that he needed. And Everett says, you know, in many ways, it is harder to forgive yourself than to forgive anybody else because you live with yourself all the time, and you know your motivations, and you know that the heart of man is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. So, of course, your first step is to seek forgiveness from God. And Satan will tell you the lie that you're not worthy of the forgiveness that God extends to you. God doesn't care about you. You've done too much to be worthy of that forgiveness. 1 John 1:9 says, if we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And this is a promise for each one of us who've chosen to name the name of Christ. If you have a mirror this morning and you hold it before you, you see the image of God. He made you. He loves you. His grace extends to you. The next step is to confess the offense to the person who you sinned against. And this is going to include some level of restitution. So Exodus 22, verse 9, there's a number of verses in the Old Testament that talk about restitution. But it says, for any kind of trespass, whether it concerns an ox, a donkey, a sheep, or clothing, or any kind of lost thing which another claims to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whomever the judge condemns shall pay double to his neighbor. And I do think it's important for us to remember that when we are offering restitution, the person we ask may put the value much higher than what we think it should be. we think it wasn't that big a deal. And we had reasons, and they put the value really high on it. And you know what? Jesus has called us to pay that. And finally, at this point, we can attempt to reach towards self-forgiveness. So if instead of this path, we simply spend our time excusing ourselves, letting ourselves off the hook, we will continue to struggle. And there's something called rumination. So if you all have seen cows chewing their cud, there's people that ruminate over the past. And some people don't do this. Some people do it a lot. And it's a challenge. But God doesn't want us to live in this state. So as I was thinking about this, I remembered a story that happened to me not long after I went into practice. I was a young doctor, and I had a patient who's middle-aged who came in to see me with headaches. And I examined him, and there didn't seem to be any significant neurologic issues, and so I told him he probably had some tension headaches. And I sent him on his way with some medicine for that, And a couple months later, he went into the ER, and he had a brain scan, and he had brain cancer. And he was sent on to see cancer doctors, and he didn't respond to treatment. But he wasn't seeing me. He was seeing these cancer doctors. And one day, several months after that, I was at the hospital. I discovered he'd been admitted there, and he was getting ready to be admitted to hospice. And I asked his nurse if she would check with him, if it was okay if I came in to his room and said hi to him. And she checked, and they said it was okay. And I went into the room, and I remember going in there. And Marty, not his name, but I'll call him Marty, and his two daughters were sitting there. And I sat down at his bedside, and I told him, I want to apologize because you came in to see me with headaches, and I didn't do testing that would have revealed your cancer. And the three of them were very kind. And they immediately extended forgiveness to me. And I have to tell you, it was a really hard thing for me to do, to walk down that hallway. And the whole time I was doing it, I was arguing with myself whether I needed to do it. But when it was done, and when I had received forgiveness, it was like a burden had been lifted off of me. And I was so glad. As I study the Bible, I find that so many of the things that we find in its pages require humility to put into action. Most of us don't like to say that we were wrong. We don't like to admit that we caused someone else pain. And we would like to explain why it wasn't as big a deal as they thought it was. So we see up here verses that I would like to think about in closing. So we know the story of Zacchaeus. He was a wee little man. And as Jesus was coming into Jericho, Zacchaeus wanted to meet Jesus. And he climbed up in a tree. And as Jesus was coming along, he looked up in the tree, the song says, and he said, Zacchaeus, you come down, for I'm going to your house today. And Jesus went to Zacchaeus' house, and he ate with him. At the end of the meal, Zacchaeus stood. This is Luke 19, verses 8 and 10. Then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, Lord, look, I give half of my goods to the poor. And if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. And I don't know what story comes to your mind when you think of asking forgiveness of others. This might not be the one. But Zacchaeus realized he had sinned against a lot of people. And they were real people. And it was real money that he owed them. And here he committed to two things. He is going to give half of his money away, and to every single person that he'd been dishonest with, he would go confess his offense to them and give them four times as much as he owed them. Suddenly, Zacchaeus turned from being a rich man into a very poor man. And yet, you know what? He was far richer than he'd ever been in his life. I don't know this morning where you sit if you've dealt with something like that. Do you feel like you're a victim or an offender? Most of us have worn both of those clothes, and neither one is easy. To humble yourself and confess is hard, but to forgive somebody who's callously hurt you is hard too. I just pray that we would take these words to heart and that we would understand. More than anything else, I want our little church here at Bethel to be known by its love for each other. And sometimes that love is going to come out as forgiveness.